This episode is sponsored by InMobi. How can marketers deliver personalized experiences on mobile that resonate with InMobi's insights, audiences, and addressability? Find your customers with their 10,000 premium audiences, or build your own with their cutting-edge ID-less addressability framework. Track your campaign's performance with their insights platform. Go to InMobi.com to learn how InMobi gives you more.
Some organizations are stepping back from saying it's going to be a catastrophe. They're kind of looking at digital health tools and technologies like AI to maybe fill some of the gaps and to answer patient questions, say.
Hey gang, it's Tuesday, May 16th. Lisa, Rajiv, and listeners, welcome to the Behind the Numbers Daily and eMarketer podcast made possible by InMobi. I'm Marcus. Today I'm joined by two folks. First of all, we have our principal analyst covering digital health based out of Connecticut. It's Lisa Phillips.
Hello, Marcus.
Hey, Lisa. We're also joined by one of our senior analysts also covering digital health based out of New Jersey. It's Rajiv Leventhal.
Hey, Marcus. Thanks for having me.
Hey, fella. So, today's fact. If your phone is out of sight, it really is out of mind. A 27 study from the McComb School of Business at the University of Texas at Austin, published in the Journal of the Association of Consumer Research, found that being able to see your phone, even when you resist the temptation to check it, decreases your cognitive capacity, or the total amount of information the brain is capable of retaining at any one time. I've been trying to do better at not having it on the table when I'm like out with people, but even at home, just having it there is a problem.
Just so tempted to pick it up.
I know, don't even think about it, Rajiv. Don't even look at it. But the study also found it didn't matter whether a person's smartphone was turned on or off, or whether it was lying face up or face down. Having a smartphone within sight or within easy reach reduces a person's ability to focus and perform tasks because part of their brain is actively working to not pick up or use the phone. So you're trying to fight against it, which is tragic. But so true. Anyway, today's real topic, the US physician population. In today's episode, first in the lead, we'll take a peek behind the curtain at the lives of physicians in the US. Then for another news, we'll discuss which chatbots are best at giving medical advice and whether medical credit cards are the way to go when it comes to paying off medical debt. We start, of course, with the lead, US physicians. Lisa, you have just put out a report on the US physician population and what it looks like today. So we're talking all about physicians. We're going to talk about what the population looks like. We're going to talk about where they are working, how much money they make, burnout, all those things. But we'll start top line. How many physicians are there in America?
Well, I was actually a little surprised when I found the number. I thought it would be higher, but it's about 1.1 million who are professionally active. And I have to say, that was the key for our report. We only wanted to look at doctors who are actually working as clinicians. There's a lot that graduate from medical school and get a license, but then they go do other things. They go to law school, some, you know, things like that. So there's more than 1 million professionally active physicians in the US right now.
Okay. That's from the, is it Kaiser Family Foundation, right? KFF?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so just over 1 million professionally active in the US in 2023. What does it look like when you zoom in on that? What kinds of doctors are within that 1 million? What's the share?
Well, yeah, you hear so much about primary care physicians, and they're the first line of, you know, doctor that people go to. And that's like 46, 47% of the population are primary care physicians, which also includes internal medicine, family medicine, general practice, and pediatrics and OBGYN. Then there's the rest are specialists, 53.4%. And then it's like psychiatry and surgery, anesthesiology, emergency medicine, and lots of others.
Okay. So primary care physicians, interesting. The slight minority, 47% specialist physicians, the slight majority, 53%.
Well, they make less, primary care physicians. I know we're going to touch on that in a little bit, but I think that's one factor explaining that data point. Yeah.
Okay. I was wondering why.
It's a tough life too, I mean, I have to say. Right, yeah. All right. Yeah, we'll touch on that later too.
Yes. So in the report, Lisa, you note that in terms of who those folks are, what are the demographics, most are men, 63%, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation, and also most are older. You're saying the mean age among licensed physicians was 52 in 2020, according to the Federation of State Medical Boards. That would be 13 years older than the median age of the US population, according to the US Census. So they're old, so they're male, about two-thirds of them, and they're older. So how are the demographics of US physicians changing?
Well, more women are going to medical school and graduating. The US physician population right now does not reflect the general makeup of the US population, because there's way more Asian doctors. There's like maybe 5.7% of the US population, but they're almost 21% of the US physician population. And the number of Black and Hispanic doctors are also disproportionately lower than the general population. But the American Medical Association are really trying to open more spots for more doctors of color in residency programs.
Yeah. You mentioned more women getting into medicine, a lot more. December 2022, AAMC, you say, reported women made up the majority, 54% of total US medical school enrollments. Rajiv, does anything jump out to you when you think about the changing demographics of US physicians?
Well, I was thinking about patients. You know, patients, there's big trust issues in healthcare. And if you're, you know, a particular minority patient and you might feel more comfortable seeing a doctor that speaks the same language and is of the same ethnicity, but that's not always the case. As Lisa mentioned and mentioned in her report, the demographics of physicians don't match up with the diversity of the US population. So, you know, that is an issue in some areas of the country for, you know, patients who might have language barriers and cultural barriers and things like that.
Yeah. Seeing a physician who can relate to your world, to your circumstance, can often be important for folks. Okay. So despite there being over a million physicians in the US, how serious is this projected shortage? So you note that there's a projected shortage of between 40 to 120,000 physicians that may occur by 2034. So basically in like 10 years or so. How serious is this?
Well, this is it's not a new problem. This has been, you know, this range has been out there for over 20 years. It's been, we're going to have a shortage. We're going to have a shortage. The numbers keep changing. So I don't know where the source is for those statistics, but I've seen much lower numbers and it keeps changing. Sometimes it's always about, say, gastroenterologists or psychiatrists. We're going to have serious shortages there each, you know, has a trade association that will put out numbers.
Okay.
But they're actually kind of, some organizations are stepping back from saying it's going to be a catastrophe. They're kind of looking at digital health tools and technologies like AI to maybe fill some of the gaps and to answer patient questions, say. That's where generative AI can come in perhaps in a while. So they're saying maybe there, you know, it won't be as such an acute shortage.
Okay, so is it a shortage in the sense that just there's always a shortage? Like we could always use more people at work.
Too. Yeah,
like people who are like working in any job, I think to themselves, like, oh, I could really do with a few more colleagues being hired because I'm like drowning in work. Is it just a kind of a case of, oh, there's always a perpetual shortage? And actually, it's not going to be a shortage to the point of it being like a complete collapse of the healthcare system.
Well, you would think, depending on some predictions, but they're always within that is, and the boomers are aging and they're going to need so many doctors. And that's another reason why they're predicting shortages. But, you know, the system's changing slowly. I mean, people don't have to be in hospitals.
Right.
Sometimes they can be at home where they're more comfortable and there doesn't need 24-hour care or, you know, doesn't need to be 24-hour care.
So is that, Rajiv, is that going to be the more of the solution here, this kind of health at home movement as opposed to technology coming in and solving this shortage of doctors?
It is, but you know, you need clinicians for health at home too. No, I don't see the system collapsing to your question, but we're already seeing the impact of these shortages in some areas. The average wait time for a family doctor across most US counties for a new family doctor is like 21 days. And for certain specialists,
that's
it's more
staggering.
Than that. It's closer to 30.
Yeah,
it could be months. And then that's the average. So that is 2022 data from Merritt Hawkins. So, you know, in some cases it could be worse depending on what your need is. Mm-hmm. And that shortage has really been pushing patients to seek other options, whether that's retail health or direct-to-consumer telehealth, if it's not a serious issue, or urgent care, or in the worst case, emergency care. But we're already seeing the impact. And, you know, like Lisa said, the numbers can vary depending on what source you look at in terms of the projected shortage. But if we're already seeing the impact now when we have been for a few years, that's not a great sign for the future.
So you write, Lisa, that U.S. physicians are increasingly leaving their independent practices for networks. How come?
Well, there's an awful lot of regulations like electronic health records, all the technology that they need to buy. That's pretty expensive. And so joining a network, they can take advantage of all the back office operations and billing and so on that larger practice or network will take care of, or hospital. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're going to hospitals as well. They also want to have a steadier work hours and not have to be on call, you know, till midnight every, you know, 5 days a week or something. And also that when the pandemic hit, a lot of doctors that were relying on fee for service being reimbursed, they knew what they were going to get. Suddenly, you know, their offices were closed or, you know, then it all went to telehealth and reimbursement became a, you know, longer stretch. And a lot of doctors just couldn't make it.
Right.
Yeah. A lot of small practices had to close down.
Yeah.
Okay. So talking about work-life balance and also a doctor shortage, the COVID-19 pandemic put a lot of pressure on everyone, fewer more so than physicians. There's this conversation being had. I mean, it's been had for years and years, but it's definitely a very prominent conversation being had at the moment around physician burnout. Can you help quantify the concerns around physician burnout?
So doctors feel overworked. And although, you know, again, different sources will say their average work hours or this or that, I did find a study that said, you know, over the last 20 years, actually between 2001 and 2021, their work hours, average weekly work hours declined. But get this, they declined from like an average of 53 hours per week to like 49 hours per week. Not a lot. And that's still a lot of hours. An average. So obviously some are working fewer, some are working more, but they're also seeing more patients than ever. The pandemic took away patients, but now that, you know, offices are open, people who didn't get care are finding they need it more. Now there's much more acute care going needed. And so people are really going back to doctors again.
Those numbers are so interesting. So from Journal of the American Medical Association, internal medicine study, are the numbers you're citing. But you're right, they came down 4 hours from 53 to 49. However, 49 hours a week is like 25% more hours than the typical 9 to 5. So they're still high. Uh-huh. Physician mothers were the only group to increase weekly work hours, you point out, is up 3% over those last 20 years. So physician mothers, their hours actually went up, which is just staggering.
Just a quick point, you know, Lisa touched on it before, but the administrative and the documentation burden is part of this burnout equation too. Another JAMA study from a few years ago that's been so widely cited in the industry found that for every hour the doctors spend on caring for patients and visiting with patients, they spend 2 hours documenting their notes, submitting claims to insurers to get paid. So that's contributing to it too. It's not like you have to kind of zoom in on the hours. It's not just the hours. It's what are they doing during those hours? And are they working after hours? They call that pajama time.
Right. Okay. So you talked about zooming in and figuring out exactly what the problem is here. It's not just the time, but what are they doing with that time? So if you were both, I'm going to make you both co-chief health officers of the US, which is a made up job, and you were asked to write a top 3 list of ways to address physician burnout, what would you put down? So together, you've got to come up with 3 for me.
Well, for one, I would do to narrow in, let them work at the top of their license so that you can hire more administrative people, maybe more medical scribes, to do all the things that doctors don't want to do and didn't go to medical school for. Let them worry about being at the best of their ability to treat patients, and let admin people and lower level staff do the documentation and the note-taking and the administrative stuff.
Okay, that's one.
Well, to that I would add, bring in ChatGPT or some AI-powered op tool that would also help with medical scribing, transcribing medical notes and so on. Also, automatically filling refills. It is coming to a point where some clinical decision systems will be employing some AI in there. So the doctor may get a nudge about, well, maybe you want to suggest this patient may have this or that. But yeah, to Rajiv's point, putting an AI tool in the electronic health record to run alongside what's being talked about and so on, and capturing the notes and being able to distill them and put diagnostic codes in there and knowing which diagnostic codes this particular insurer will not flag or doesn't usually flag, because that's the, that's a huge time suck for them too.
Right.
Is dealing with insurance companies.
Okay.
But it's so important for them to get paid, but it's it's annoying and burdensome.
Yeah, they feel like, you know, that's all they're doing is really, they're just there for the insurance companies.
I'll come in with a third here quickly, if you don't mind, Lisa. I think primary care physicians should get paid more. I don't know, Lisa, if you, in your research, you looked at primary care physicians in rural areas. You know, rural areas are not as desirable to live in as metro areas, so they have to pay.
Ooh, don't say that out loud.
to some people.
Yes.
So they have to pay those rural doctors more, but I'm not sure if the gap is wide enough to offset the physician shortage that you're seeing in rural areas. And, you know, you see some of these salaries from specialty physicians that are just out of this world. You know, I think primary care physicians should get a greater piece of that pie.
So Lisa, you note the highest paying jobs in the US are in medicine, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. How much are doctors making?
Well, according to the BLS, the median annual income in 2022 was $208,000 a year, but it depends on the specialty. And like I said, primary care physicians, pediatricians, internal and family medicine doctors, general practitioners all make less than surgeons and anesthesiologists. And well, I want to say plastic surgeons actually made the most. The average primary care physician earned $260,000 a year, and specialists averaged $368,000.
Okay.
But plastic surgeons make the most, and that's upwards of $700,000 a year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the average is 208 for primary.
Well, the median, they said,
The median is 208. Yeah. That's right. Primary care is 260, specialist 370.
And these are big salaries compared to the, of course, to the average working American. But I think my point was, like, when you compare them amongst their peers, primary care physicians should get a greater piece and maybe cosmetic surgeons.
Yeah. Well, so to your point, I mean, it's four times the median US salary, so $54,000. But they're also keeping people alive, I would argue is the most important job on the planet. So there's a reason that these folks should be paid that. But then also, you know, Lisa, the average medical school graduate carries $250,000 in total student loan debt with interest on top every year. So they also need that money to pay back all of those school expenses.
And that's why a lot of them feel underpaid.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't enter the workforce until later, way later than most people, because you have so much school.
Oh yeah, late 20s.
Right, like 30s at the earliest?
Yeah, late 20s, early 30s, yeah.
Okay, depending on what you're going for. I'll throw in a fourth here in terms of ways to address physician burnout. I thought this one was really interesting from your report, Lisa. You note that many doctors could use more vacation time. Average time off for most US employees, 10 to 14 days a year, which is horrifyingly low. That's from according to Indeed, the job search people. But among doctors, you say 64% of doctors take 3 or more weeks of vacation per year. 28% take just 1 to 2 weeks, according to Medscape's lifestyle report. It's too low. Anyway, that's all we got time for the lead. Time for the halftime report. Lisa, I'll start with you. What's the one most important thing you said in the first half of the show that you think people need to take away with them?
That the doctor population is changing. It's becoming more female and younger, and they're bringing different demands into the workplace.
Reggie?
Then I hope that the trend that Lisa wrote about doctors becoming more diverse continues to accelerate in that direction, because patient trust is really important in today's. It's always been important, but it's especially important today. And, you know, patients need doctors that they ethnically and from a language standpoint can feel really comfortable with.
Lisa's full report we've been referencing is called U.S. Physicians 2023, What the Demographics of a Professional Population Mean to Marketers and Providers. Link in the show notes or head to insiderintelligence.com. That's it for the first half. Time for the second. Today in other news, chatbots go head-to-head in a medical advice competition, and are medical credit cards as good as advertised? Story one, Lisa, you just wrote an article pointing out that chatbots are going head-to-head in a medical advice competition. In the piece, you explain that 500 healthcare professionals recently rated responses to common medical questions from OpenAI's ChatGPT, Google's Bard, and Microsoft's Bing as part of a survey by Tebra. Questions were on stress and anxiety, a healthy diet, lowering blood pressure, wine consumption, and sleep. 44% of healthcare professionals said ChatGPT gave the best responses. Just behind that was Bard, Google's Bard, with 42%. And way behind that with 14% was folks who said Bing. But Lisa, the takeaway from this chatbot's medical advice research is what and why?
There's a reason they're called chatbots. They really chatted away. I read the responses, all good, but very general, just saying, well, a healthy diet consists of this and that and the other thing and on and on. It just, you couldn't really go wrong unless you said eating Oreos is your best bet, you know, staying healthy. You
know, maybe it is.
Eating a pack of Oreos a day or something. And the other side of this is, Tebra said healthcare professionals, but they didn't specify what the clinical level of these healthcare professionals was. So I always read the methodologies.
Yeah.
Also, I'll say one more thing, that
please,
there's so much, we're still talking about perceptions here. There's no real data except, you know, the which chatbots passed the medical licensing exams and so on.
Right.
There's, you know, there's no data. This is all perceptions that are out
right
there.
Right. So, and we're talking about it a lot, so it seems like everyone's doing this, but you know, the survey says that just 1 in 10 healthcare professionals are using AI-powered chatbots at this point. Story two, Rajivi recently noted that medical credit cards aren't as good as advertised, according to a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, CFPB report. In it, they warn that consumers should be wary of medical credit cards and other types of loans to pay off healthcare expenses. Rajiv, how come?
Well, because these low and no interest credit cards that are sometimes advertised in waiting rooms when patients go into a clinic or a hospital are not what they seem. They might be low or no interest for 6 or 12 months. But then after that promotional period ends, this report found that those interest rates accrue up to like 27% that first month or even higher after the promotional period ends. And the doctors that are being sold these credit cards by financial institutions don't know the T's and the C's and the fine print. So that confusion gets passed on to the patients. Mm. And it's just really a bad situation. I mean, we're dealing with sick patients here, not overly aggressive shoppers who rack up thousands and thousands right of dollars of bad credit. So I'm glad that there is, there are people, important people and influential people looking at this, because, you know, sick patients should not be saddled with such significant medical debt.
It's hard to deal with financial concerns at the best of times, let alone when you're ill. And at your often lowest points. Two things that you noted that jumped out to me. One, medical credit cards carrying higher interest rates than general purpose credit cards, saddling consumers with large amounts of debt, you note. And then two, over 100 million Americans, so 41% of adults, are in healthcare related debt, according to 2022 KFF Health News Analysis. Over 100 million Americans. Shocking. That's all we've got time for this episode. Thank you so much to my guests. Thank you to Lisa.
Thank you, Marcus. Good to see you.
You too. Thank you, Rajiv.
Yeah, thank you, Marcus. Had a good time.
Yes, sir. Thank you to Victoria, who edits the show, James, who copy edits it, and Stuart, who runs the team. Thanks to everyone listening in to the Behind the Numbers Daily, an e-marketer podcast made possible by InMobi. Tune in tomorrow to listen to the Reimagining Retail show hosted by Sarah Lebo, where she'll be speaking with analysts Sky Canavis and Jamie Toplin about the latest on mobile wallets.